Okay, we're going to invite Jim up now. And so he's a part of the Creation Ministries International. He was reminding me it's been in business for 40 years now across the globe. So we're thankful that you're here with us. Appreciate it. Give him a warm welcome this morning.
Live. Hello. Am I live now? Yeah. So thank you for the prayer for Richard. He has a young family, and it's important that he be there at this time. So they called me up from the minors. I'm a volunteer with CMI. I'm not on full-time staff, so they asked me to take on an extra session here. So God willing, we will be helpful for you. So when you look at what the evolutionists say about mankind, and here's an example by Stephen Jay Gould, who was a professor at Harvard University. He says, mankind is a fortuitous cosmic afterthought, a tiny little twig on the bush of life. Richard Dawkins, an outspoken atheist, he says, we live in a universe which has no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. So according to evolutionists like these, and there's others like Bertrand Russell and others like that, they say that man is basically a bag of chemicals, that it's just by chance that we are here. So when you start with a foundation of evolution, and we have had evolution pounded into our society for about 170 years, at least the modern form. There's an earlier form that goes right back to the Greeks at the time of Aristotle. But the evolution from the time of Charles Darwin that has been pounded into us from the popular media and from the academic world, including, sad to say, professing Christian universities and seminaries. When you have this underlying foundation, we see the results of it. We see what's happening, for instance, with some of the legislation coming out of our federal government right now, the chaos in cities in the United States. Thankfully, it hasn't flowed over much into Canada, but we see the results of this chaos, and it is the result of evolutionary thinking, because if man has no purpose and no meaning and there is no morality, then, as it says in the book of Judges, everyone does what's right in his own eyes. And that's where we're at. In contrast, when you start with the foundation of biblical creation, you have a completely different worldview. Now, in a moment, I'm going to pause and I'm going to ask a non-rhetorical question. So put your thinking hats on and see if you can answer this. Why did I put biblical creation below God's word? Isn't the most important thing God's word? Think about it for a second. When we start this foundation, we find the rule of law. When God says to Adam, you shall not eat of a particular tree. And we know the consequences when Adam and Eve ate of that tree. They broke God's law. We find marriage when Eve is brought to Adam as a helpmeet. We're also told that a man and a woman are to cling together, and that's in Genesis through the marriage relationship. We also have meaning and standards for life. For example, the standards are in the law and explicit throughout, but the meaning is, for instance, in Genesis 1:26, where God gives many theologians refer to as the cultural mandate, and that is we're to have dominion over the creation. Paul reemphasizes that, by the way, in a different form in 1 Corinthians 10:31, where he says, do all for the glory of God. And so we have a purpose in life, to honor God. Now, why did I put biblical creation below God's word? Anybody want to make a suggestion? I wasn't going to say make a guess, but take a suggestion. Why biblical creation below God's word? Yes, sir. You have to speak loudly because I'm partly deaf and I wear a hearing aid. So,
because the word was before the beginning.
Well, that's an interesting one. That's very interesting. It's not quite what I was had in mind, but it's quite interesting. Think about Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, and then a couple verses thereafter. Yes, sir. Well, that's what we were getting, but that's coming out of John, not out of Genesis. Okay, that's coming out of John chapter 1, which is certainly valid, and it's a different perspective. But then you would say, well, in the beginning was the Word. Shouldn't I put the Word below? How does Genesis open? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we read on, and he said, let there be light. Notice the order. God presents himself first. The very first thing he wants you to know is that he's a creator. Secondly, he wants you to know that he's a communicator. That's the order. Don't miss that, because throughout Scripture, he indicates his power, his authority as a creator. You can find it emphasized by the prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah. You find the writer of Hebrews mentioning it. You find Peter mentioning it. You find Jesus mentioning it. And there's a classic one in Job, where after all of these debates between Job and his supposed friends, at the end of it, what does God do? He challenges him. He says, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? That's where God wants us to start. If we don't start with the doctrine of creation, we may as well pack up our Bibles and leave, because that's where God starts. So get that fundamental down. Now, many Christians will say, yeah, I believe that God created. They're not sure what they mean by that. They're not sure how he did it, but they say they believe that God is the creator. And many will say, I have a Christian worldview. I'm against transgenderism and against abortion and all these things. But the problem that we find in the ministry of CMI is to churches. That's our focus. And we find many in the churches who have lots of confusion about things like, well, did God use evolutionary processes to bring about what he has made? And they are so influenced by the media and the academic community that they believe that the universe is 13.8 billion years old and that the world is 4.5 billion years old. And if you ask them why, well, they'll say the fossil record as an example. We're going to look at that, some of that in a minute. So what happens, though, is when the church follows the world and is not able to give satisfactory answers to the kinds of questions that young people and adults have, young people start to exit the church. When they are confronted by evolutionary psychology, evolutionary anthropology, evolutionary biology in their university courses, even if they went to a Christian school or they were homeschooled, they hit a brick wall with these dogmatic professors and they have serious doubts and many leave the church. And when surveys are conducted why young people leave the church, it's not the only reason, but it's the most common reason, because of evolution. So the challenge we have is then, how do we get this message, the foundational message that God is the creator? And it is, everybody has questions unless they've studied this in depth. For instance, where does an ice age fit? How do dinos fit? And by the way, I'll do an advertisement. After lunch, we're going to do dinos and man and show how dinos fit. And then we have questions about, well, how did Cain and Abel get their first wives? Things like that. So we have about the Genesis flood. Was it a local flood or a global flood? The interesting thing is, when I started to get involved in this topic in high school, I was invited by a classmate of mine. We went to Sir John A. MacDonald Collegiate in Scarborough, and he invited me down to Wishing Well Acres Baptist Church, and there was a speaker there by the name of Whitcomb. And he wrote a book with Morris and Whitcomb called The Genesis Flood. And from I bought a copy just like this, there was a book table there, and I consumed that. And when I went to university, I studied a lot of science and had my master's degree and a theology degree. And I've pursued this topic in depth because it's fascinated me since I was in high school. But what's interesting is the amount of information that's become available in the last 20 years that supports biblical creation and undermines evolution is phenomenal. And we can be very confident that we have answers and that we can defend our position. So what I want to do is consider some evidence that will support biblical creation. But before I do that, I have to define evolution because I've already used it a number of times. Now, there are various definitions. In fact, I was at a church the other day. I forget. I've been in Burns Lake and I've been in all over the place here. But somebody said, well, I believe in macroevolution, but not in micro or vice versa. We don't use those kinds of terms at CMI. Let me define evolution. And then I'm not creating a straw man. I will give you an evolutionist definition. The idea is that all of life began with a single cell that had enough information and enough ability to move around and reproduce and eat and all those things. We would call it alive. And over time, genetic information has been increasing as various processes have been going on. And by the time you get up to human beings, you have orders of magnitude more genetic information than a single cell. Just to give an example, apparently the simplest bacteria that we would consider alive and self-maintaining has about 482 genes. It's called C. elegans. 482 genes. The human genome has 25,000 genes. So there's been an increase in information. That's their claim. When we move up to the present, we see all of the species around us, plants and animals, bacteria, insects, everything. Some of the life forms have died out. Some died out in the flood or only found in the fossil record. Some have died out during the Ice Age, like saber-toothed cats and woolly mammoths and giant sloths and so on. And then there are the missing links. And that is not a term that creationists invented. It's a term that evolutionists use. And that is that there are the gaps. They can't explain how a fish became an amphibian or a reptile became a bird. And they're constantly looking for the missing links. And I'm not going to go into detail on that today. I have a detailed presentation on the topic of evolution there. But here's the definition by Lynn Margulis. She isn't alive anymore, so I think she knows the truth now. But she stated, every form of life on Earth, oak, tree, and elephant, bird, and bacterium, shares a common ancestry with every other form. And then she goes on to state it's a fact. You see, the idea that the evolution is that everything started from a single cell. And there's been an increase in genetic information. This is not evolution. The canine kind that came out of the ark has speciated through natural selection into different environmental niches, wolves and coyotes and foxes and so on, and domestic dogs. And then human selection for a long period of time has bred out different breeds. And you know that highly specialized breeds of dogs have less robust lives. For instance, Great Danes die young of heart attacks. Many bulldogs have breathing problems, things like that. And sometimes I wonder why people breed some of these funny-looking creatures. But this is not evolution. They have actually lost genetic information. If you want a robust dog, what are you going to get? A mutt, right? Because you get all back some of the genetic information. Just to give you a personal example, one of my daughters-in-law is Chinese, and I tell Ryan and Claudia that they have brought two different gene pools together, and Charlie is the most brilliant kid on the face of the earth. Of course, he's my grandson, right? This is not evolution either. This is a tea that has been found in northern China in a province, and it's caffeine-free. I suspect that if they're able to breed enough of this, it's going to become quite popular because some people like to have caffeine-free tea and coffee and so on. Now, does anybody know why coffee, tea, and cocoa plants and others have caffeine. Anybody want to take a guess why they have caffeine? Caffeine is a pesticide. It protects the plants from caterpillar infestations. So I've had 2 cups of tea today, and I've been drinking pesticides. We drink them in such low quantities that it doesn't poison us. But you know what happens when you get those supposedly high energy drinks? They can be disruptive to the nervous system, and there's too much caffeine in them. So the economist in describing this says, on closer inspection on the genetics, the absence of caffeine is a result of a mutation in the gene that codes for a particular enzyme. It's called caffeine synthase. Why don't they just use simple names? The enzyme that makes caffeine, you know? Just so. And but notice what the article says. It's made its evolutionary journey toward losing the ability to produce caffeine. This isn't evolution. This is devolution. Losing information, decay. And the reality is this plant could not survive in the wild without humans protecting it. And if they're going to grow fields and fields of this, they're going to have to use artificial pesticides to protect this plant. Just as an aside, if you knew what it takes to create decaffeinated coffee and tea, the chemicals they have to use to extract the caffeine, you'll never again drink decaffeinated drinks. So I'm looking forward to them bringing this out. So we declare emphatically that God created in 6 natural days, consecutive natural days, that is what we would say days with 24 hours, and he did this over the space of 6 sequential days, and he did it about 6,000 years ago. I expect to see a few heads exploding right now when I say 6,000 years. And they will ask me, do you really believe the universe and the world is only 6,000 years old? And I say emphatically, yes. So just keep that 6,000 in mind. I do have other presentations, which I'm not going to give today, on defending the age of the earth as young, and then also the universe is young. And I deal with the Big Bang and things like that. But let's just remember the number 6,000. I'm going to ask you later, and there'll be an exam to remember if you remember this number. So what I want to do is give you quick 5 reasons for why we believe in biblical creation. And I can only do a high-level survey in this presentation, but we're going to go through 5. First, I want to just demonstrate to you that Genesis 1 is to be understood as a historical account. And I'm actually going to spend the most time on that, because if we don't get Genesis 1 right, we're not going to get anything right. Second, briefly, death is a result of Adam's sin. Thirdly, I want to do a quick sweep through some challenges that evolutionists cannot give you answers for. And if you've got people who are, you're having friends and you're talking about evolution, you might try to use some of these questions to flummox them. Third, just 4 or 5 pieces of evidence that the world can't be billions of years old. And then finally, some facts that support the Genesis flood. So that's what we're going to sweep through, high level, and we'll see how we go. So on the left-hand side is the sequence that the evolutionists will present to you, in which if you read Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, and Carl Sagan's introduction in the book, they will say that there was nothing, and then there was a quantum ripple. Now, put your thinking hats on. If there's nothing, how can there be something? But putting that's a challenge. And then from there on, they talk about plasma forming atoms and then atoms forming molecules and all the way. And this is the sequence on the left. On the right is the sequence taken out of Genesis chapter 1. And you cannot bring these two sequences together. For example, the plant life is created on day 3. The stars and the sun are created on day 4. And yet in the evolutionary sequence, you have to have stars billions of years before planets come along. And you have to have a planet for what? The first life on the earth might be 1.2 billion years. So you're talking 3.3 3 billion years as the planet is supposedly forming. You can't bring these two together. When you, a basic law of logic called the law of non-contradiction says if you've got two things that are contrary to one another, at least one of them has to be false. So let's determine which makes more sense. So there are various theories that people have attempted to rationalize those. I'm not going to cover those now, but let's just take one example. Some people, well, Genesis 1 is just poetry. It isn't poetry, but it is a magnificent piece of literature, without a question. So the natural reading of the text is it's a narrative piece. In fact, a PhD in Hebrew did an analysis on this. His name is Stephen Boyd, and he looked at the verbs that are available in poetic books like the Book of Psalms or the Song of Solomon, and then he looked at verb forms that are found in narrative texts, say like 1 and 2 Samuel, and the verb forms that are in Genesis 1 are overwhelmingly the narrative verb forms. So it's not taking, there's other arguments about why it's not poetry. It doesn't have the idea parallelism and so on that you find in Hebrew poetry, but it's just not, it's narrative. Second, it's presented as part of a historical chronology in a historical account. It just flows all the way till Abraham, who appears on the scene around the end of chapter 11, and then we go on right into it. There's no break in it, it's just a continuous narrative of a historical account. We're also told that God created in 6 days, and he did this to set a pattern for our week. There have been attempts in history. In the French Revolution, they tried to introduce a 10-day week, and it failed miserably. Stalin tried to do the same thing at the time of the Russian Revolution, and again, it failed miserably. Everywhere in the world, people observe a 7-day week. It goes right back to Genesis. You can't explain it any other way. We also have in the Hebrew something that's a little peculiar, and we see it in English. Not so much in modern translation. In our congregation, we use the ESV. I think you use an NIV. So you won't see it in modern translations. But if you go back to the old King James, a lot of the uses of the word and. Like now, they either just don't translate it or they say then or now and those kinds of things. It's not wrong. It's just different. But this and gives the idea of a sense of continuous events that occur one right after the other. And it's a historical sequence. And there was evening and there was morning. And God said. These are events that are just going along. By the way, if you want to see that kind of urgency, read the Gospel of Mark. Mark just pulls you along fast. And he says, Jesus did this, and Jesus did this, and Jesus said that. And he's thinking with a Hebrew mindset, but he's writing in, probably in Greek. We also have an interesting construct in the Genesis account with the use of the ordinal. Now, the first one isn't an ordinal. It's not first day. It's day one. But it's the cardinal. But the rest of them are the second day, the third day, the fourth day. If you go to Numbers chapter 7 and Numbers 29, when the sacrifices are being presented, you will see the use of the ordinal there. There isn't a theologian on the face of the earth who's going to tell you that we are to take these as non-natural days. Then why are they imposing on Genesis 1 that these aren't natural days? Be consistent. And then the natural days all have an evening and a morning. Think about it. How could God tell us that these are natural days? Well, he says they had an evening and a morning. He can't say, well, they had 24 hours. The concept of a 24 hours, an artifact post-flood. And why 24 hours? The Swiss watch company, if you go to their website, they say, let's go to 10-hour days with 100 hours in a minute and 100 seconds, in 100 minutes in an hour and 100 seconds in a minute. But why not? It makes good sense. It'd make it a lot easier to try to remember whether you're talking 10 a.m. or 10 p.m. and things like that, right? And having to use military time and... So why not? Natural days, evening and morning. And then in Exodus 20, God says, I did this, therefore you shall do this. If God didn't really create in 6 days and rest on the seventh, then he's not telling us the truth. It's that simple. And then Jesus declares that mankind are right from the beginning, not from 13.8 billion years after the beginning. And then the rest of the writers, many of the writers in the New Testament, refer to Genesis 1 as a historical account. So I cannot emphasize enough, don't fall for these, all these hypotheses that are out there, the day-age view, the gap theory, the framework hypothesis, and all this stuff. Genesis 1 is telling us exactly what God the Creator did. And he's telling us he did it in six natural days over a space of a week. So the writer of Hebrews says, by faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made of things that are visible. And by the way, this, if you need a proof text that God didn't use theistic evolution, this is it right here. Paul uses an interesting analogy. He accepts that God created and said, let there be light physically, and then he applies it spiritually, and he takes the analog over. So that's our first topic. Genesis 1 is a historical narrative, and God was there, and he's telling us what he did. Let's just briefly look at the problem of death. Death is introduced by Adam's sin into the world. But think about this. After God had created and completed the 6 days of creation, he saw everything he had made, and he declared it to be very good. But if there has been 450 million years of evolution, starting with the Cambrian explosion and going all the way up to, say, the Triassic, and when dinosaurs start appearing and they've gone extinct 65 million years ago, there's been death, decay, destruction, suffering, disease, and that is all very good? I don't know what the word good means if that's the case. And Adam's sin brought the curse of death and decay, not only on the human race, but on all the what God defines as living creatures that have the breath of life in them. And it brought death on all those creatures, and it brought decay into the universe. Your cars rust, tractors fall apart because of what Adam did in sinning. And so every single fossil, every one of them, must have been formed after Adam's sin. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean everyone was formed in the flood, but the bulk of them were. And some may have been formed in subsequent events like the Ice Age. And it's interesting, if we do not accept the view that we have a historical Adam who was a unique creation, who sinned and brought death upon mankind, then we cannot have a historical Christ who paid the debt of sin. The two are absolutely have to be there together. And Paul tells us that in that great chapter on the resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15, where he says, as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall be made alive. That is, all whom Adam represented covenantally die, because Jesus Christ was not born in natural descent because of virgin conception. So all those that Adam represented covenantally die. And all those whom Christ made alive, that is, all those whom he represents covenantally and who believe in him, are made alive. So that equation is right there. If you want to pursue this topic a little further, we had a recent episode we have been publishing or producing for 9 years, Creation Magazine Live. And this might have been the most recent episode, Did Animals Die Before Adam Sinned? And the half-hour episode, you can get it on YouTube. It's also on various other media. And we also have it broadcast on TV stations in some parts of Canada and the U.S. I am particularly biased to this one because I wrote the script for this show. So... But you can see this if you want to pursue this topic in more detail, because there's things I can't go into right now. Like, well, do insects die? Did Adam ever step on an ant? Questions like that. So that was the second topic. Third topic, I want to do a quick sweep through some things that evolutionists have real challenges discussing or defining or describing. The first thing that we have to take into account is the genetic code isn't hardware. It's software. It's a program. And even if the hardware could be generated by chance, the information in DNA is a whole additional layer of complexity. So DNA is made up of four basic letters. And the simple way to think of these is just think of them as colored beads, red, yellow, blue, and green. Just like that, they have a little hole in them so we can put them on a string. You can picture that, children's beads? Well, if you're interested in nucleotides, they're called nucleotides, and they're made up of three components, a phosphate, a nitrogen group, and a sugar. That's what they're made up of. But what we now have to do is, let's assume for the sake of discussion, the nucleotides have spontaneously popped into existence. Make that assumption. Now we got to start stringing these onto a string and spelling words, and then we got to spell or make them into sentences and into paragraph and then into chapters. That's what we got to do. Chapters are like our chromosomes. The paragraphs are genes. There's information between the genes. It's control information in the DNA, error correction utilities, and all kinds of additional information between the genes. Anybody have any idea how many of those beads we've got to string together? 2 billion for the human genome. 2 billion has to be strung together. Paul Davies said, how did nature fabricate the world's first digital information processor, the original living cell, from the blind chaos of blundering molecules? How did molecular hardware get to write its own software? So I'll make you a wager. I'll pay you $1 million if you can come to me and show me that your cell phone has written its own app. It's not going to happen. We know that. And yet we're to believe that blind chance molecules have written information and software? Because it's basically software. By the way, I'm a computer programmer. I write Java code. I've written C code and COBOL and Fortran over the years. I know how difficult it is to write a program. And the DNA is mind-boggling. Let's take it up a level. Cells have nucleuses in them. How did cells get nucleuses? There's basic theories out there. Just ask an evolutionist to show you empirically a result of how cells got nucleuses. I don't want a just-so story. I want to know, in the laboratory, how cells get nucleuses. Let's take it up a level. How did cells learn to talk to one another? The human body has over 250 different kinds of cells in it. And just to give you an illustration, if you cut your finger, immediately cells start talking to one another. They send signals, and the blood cells have to deliver the coagulant. And then once it's stopped bleeding, the next thing is, okay, guys, we need some different kinds of skin cells over here. And there are at least two different kinds of skin cells that have to come in and heal the wound. How did cells learn to talk to one another? Let's take it up a level. In an amoeba, the chromosomes duplicate and split, and then the amoeba splits. But in sexual reproduction, you get one set of chromosomes from the male, and you get one set of chromosomes from the female. How did cells decide to work together and share chromosomes and make decisions which set of DNA they're going to use? And you realize that if there's a genetic disease in one of them, the DNA corrects and uses the other. Like, it's amazing. And even if a viable entity that, say, had male sexual reproductive organs came into existence spontaneously at the same time in the same location, an entity would have had to come into existence that had female reproductive organs. The odds are beyond belief of what's going on here. Well, the Bible has the answer. God created them male and female. By the way, not 39 genders. So, and Darwin, in his book, he says, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And that's in his book on the Origin of Species. Now, various people have shown that Darwin had no idea of the complexity of the cell. All that we know about the complexity of the cell has really been discovered in the last 20 to 30 years. Cells have factories in them. And some of these terms you probably have heard of recently, but when the DNA strand opens up, it's like a zipper, and a little machine goes up on the DNA, and it creates something called messenger RNA. You've probably heard of that because there were these vaccines going around, mRNA vaccines. So it creates this mRNA, and then a truck, and I'm not being facetious here, a truck picks up it, and it carries it in the cell over to the factory that's going to create the protein. And the mRNA is scanned down and it creates the protein. A portal opens up in the cell and the protein is sent off for whatever role. And if it was a case in these vaccines, how effective they were is debatable. But that protein now goes and binds to the spike protein in the coronavirus. So that's what's been going on here. And that's all done with machinery inside of cells that are far, far more complex than any machine or city that a human being has ever built. One cell in your body has food production, waste disposal systems. It has transportation mechanisms. It has factories. And you know what? These are running at blinding speeds. Like if we were to scale them up, the truck that was carrying that messenger RNA, it would be going faster than the speed of light. These things are going super fast inside of every one of our body cells. Second thing about Darwin, so he knew nothing about the complexity of the cell. Second thing Darwin knew nothing about was DNA. The DNA was starting to be decoded in around the 1950s. Darwin published in 1859. He didn't know any idea about the DNA stuff that I've already referred to. Thirdly, he knew nothing about genetics. Mendel was working on his pea experiments in the monastery, and he published, I think it was in 1863, and nobody paid any attention to Mendel's work until about 1900. So to be blunt, Darwin was ignorant. And we don't have to look at the molecular level, but you just think of the logistics of here, how feathers were supposed to have changed, or scales were supposed to have changed into feathers, completely different substances. Or go up the fish to amphibian, like out of what we get, little tadpoles, reptilian, bird, and mammal eggs. Really, really different. Like, to think about it, think about how a bird egg is supposed to have evolved into a human egg? Anyway, you get the point. The Bible's answer is very clear. The animals were created in a mature form. Take it up another level. Did any of you grow tomatoes? The interesting thing is about tomatoes is they're actually difficult to pollinate. You could go out with a Q-tip and you can hand pollinate them. You get a little bit of wind pollination, but you need a particular kind of bee. You need bumblebees. Anybody know why you need bumblebees to pollinate? So if I come back in a year and I ask people what they remember from this presentation, this will be the only thing they will remember. You need bumblebees. Why bumblebees? Bumblebees are the only bee that hums while it works. And it hums at middle C. And when it hums at middle C, the tomato flowers vibrate open for pollination. This is what's called a symbiotic relationship, and there are hundreds of them in nature. Evolutionists cannot explain them because simply tomato plants would go extinct if they didn't have bumblebees. It's that simple. Or humans would have to cultivate them. So evolutionists find this very difficult. So let's take a fourth topic. How are we doing from time? Because we're fine? Because I tend to go into all kinds of digressions. So, okay. Oh, dear. So, we're doing okay from the content-wise, but I tend to go into migration. Huh? Oh, thank you. Yeah, maybe I will take a quick break. Thank you. Inside of our cells, there's the nucleus that has DNA in it. But there's another strand of DNA in a piece called mitochondria. Mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell. They convert the food that we've eaten into electricity to drive the factories inside of the cells. And mitochondria, and that's not mitochlorian out of Star Wars, mitochondria. But they're very interesting because they have their own strand of DNA. Now, do you remember I said the nuclear DNA is about 2 billion nucleotides long, the beads. Mitochondria DNA is 16,800 nucleotides, a lot smaller. And you can sequence 16,800 nucleotides very, very quickly. And they've done that with basically the entire human population. That doesn't mean they did everybody, but they've taken samples from every ethnic group around the world. And what's interesting is two things about it. Every human being on Earth has essentially identical mitochondria DNA. This idea of races is a Darwinian thinking. We are all one human race. And we all share identical, nearly identical mitochondria DNA. And not only that, but we don't inherit two sets of it like we do with our nuclear DNA. Our mitochondria DNA comes only from our mothers. So they can do studies on this, and they have They've taken samples from, for example, there's others, but take this as an example, from the Russian Romanov family prior to the Russian Revolution. So let's think, pretend, I don't know if this is exactly how they got it, but let's pretend there was a hair sample in a hairbrush, and it says, this is Princess Elena's hairbrush, and it's in a museum in St. Petersburg. I can take a DNA sample from that piece of hair. I can then find her descendants, and I can get a DNA sample from that. Okay? So I can compare. Remember, it comes down through the matriarchal line. So we need female line down on mitochondria DNA. And Anne Gibbons' writing about this first study says, evolutionary studies led them to expect about one mutation in 600 generations, that is one every 12,000 years. So they were stunned to find 10 base pairs, which gave them a rate of one mutation every 40 generations, or one every 800 years. So mutations have occurred. But scientists have basically been able to map all of the mutations across humankind. Because you take samples and you have a pretty good idea, and it's easy to sequence 16,800 genomes, rather 2 billion, nucleotides. So why did they expect one mutation in 600 generations? Well, they're evolutionary presuppositions. Homo sapiens had supposedly been around for 200,000 years. If you know there's this many mutations divided into 200,000, that's how you get the number of generations. So they were stunned to find that these mutations were going more quickly. And the problem is mitochondria DNA change rate is too rapid to support evolution. Because if Homo sapiens have been around for 200,000 years, there should be all kinds of genetic mutations in the mitochondria DNA. But she goes on to say, do you remember what number I asked you to keep in your head? This is the exam. 6,000. She goes on to say in her article, the measured rate indicates that mankind has been on the earth for only 6,000 years. But you know what she then says? Nobody believes that. So another one, and I have one copy of it left, is Sanford's book on genome decay. He was a professor at Cornell University. He's actually one of our scientists. He became a Christian later in life, and his whole worldview changed. And he's written a book called Genetic Entropy. And he's describing the problem. Mutations are overwhelmingly negative. There may be some benign. They've never shown a positive mutation that has been selected by natural selection. Some are benign. They're like you make a spelling mistake in a paragraph, and you can still read the paragraph. And DNA has all kinds of error correction utilities, but some are highly destructive. And it's only the change of one nucleotide can destroy an entire gene in some instances. Any idea how many genetic diseases in the human population? Over 1,000, and it's increasing. Anybody have lactose intolerance? A few people do. That is a genetic disease, and it's inherited. Not always, because remember, you get two sets of chromosomes, but it's a genetic disease. The interesting thing is that mutations are accumulating. They don't get filtered out. And so, Rob, you have mutants at your breakfast table. You're sure, you know that for sure, right? And mutations, according to Sanford, in roughly 300 generations, the human population will no longer be able to reproduce. It'll be an absolute collapse. Well, where are we? We're roughly 200 generations since Adam. We don't have to worry. We know Christ is going to take care of this, don't we? We have that faith. Evolutionists don't. They have a problem here because the genome is decaying rapidly and it's getting worse and worse and worse. Mary Schweitzer, writing the Smithsonian Magazine, that's the museums in Washington, D.C., she talks about having discovered soft tissue, blood cells, DNA, proteins in dinosaur bones. Pretty amazing. Many evolutionists were really upset when she published this. Well, that's impossible. Soft tissue can't and so on can't exist for 65 million years. We know that intuitively. What is it that you find on labels in your pantry, your refrigerator, and your medicine cabinet? Best before dates, right? Right? Best before date? Have you ever seen a best before date 65 million years? We know that organic material decays, and it decays quickly, or it will calcify in fossilization. Just simply, the world isn't as old as evolutionists claim because dinosaur bones could not contain soft tissue. The fact that they do is support, by the way, for the Genesis flood. They were only buried 4,400 years ago, not 65 million years ago. And so these are examples of recent scientific discoveries that support the Bible. One more. The Earth is a big giant magnet. A current is flowing around the Earth, and it magnetizes it. And the magnetosphere has various advantages. It's a protective shield. Some birds use it for navigation and various things. And sailors used to use it with their compasses. Nowadays, we all just have our GPS satellites telling us where we are, right? So, the magnetic field is decaying. And studies have been done indicating, and what they did was they took pottery that was cast about 1,000 AD, and there's iron inside of clay, and it took on a magnetic moment using the same techniques today. The Earth's magnetic field has decayed by about 40% in that 1,000-year period, and it's continuing to decay. Scientists know, evolutionary scientists know that the Earth's magnetic field is decaying. Just ask them how this isn't going to be a problem. And the answer is, well, it's going to regenerate. Have you ever seen it regenerate? No. Do we have laboratory evidence that it regenerates? No. Then why do we know it regenerates? Well, because the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. You know what that's called? Circular reasoning. It's that simple. Now, I'm being obviously superficial about these things just for the sake of this presentation. I can go into a lot more depth on these topics and give you a lot more evidence on the Earth is not 4.5 billion years old. It's just tired. And that's what Paul tells us. The whole creation's groaning, waiting for its redemption. And we know Jesus is going to redeem it. Peter tells us that in the days of Noah, they were waiting and then they were destroyed. But we know it's going to be consumed by fire and it's going to be instantly created. And Jesus did create the universe the first time. Paul tells us that in Colossians, where he said it was created by him and for him. And Jesus is going to recreate it, but this time he's not going to take 6 days. He's going to do it instantaneously, because God can create a universe instantaneously. There's nothing for God. And since the earth isn't old enough, there isn't enough time for evolution supposedly to occur. One last topic. You with me so far? So, the facts that support the biblical account of the flood. Mass extinctions. There are huge quantities of fossils that were destroyed. You cannot explain that by local flood catastrophes or by river delta flood floodplains. You can't explain it. And what's interesting in many of these, and this is something that evolutionists don't really want you to know, that in many of these mass extinctions, there are dinosaur bones, mammal bones, and even fish bones. How did the fish bones get in amongst the dinosaur bones? This is what is referred to as out-of-place fossils. You know, one of the theories is that over in Alberta there, I'm being a little facetious here, but over in Alberta, this big pile of bones, a huge tsunami threw the fish over the Rocky Mountains. No, they do attribute it to tsunami waves, but that can't begin to explain how they got into Alberta. It's not a problem for us. A Genesis flood covering the entire world above the highest mountains with 15 cubits of water. So a few fish get stuck with the dinosaurs. It's not a problem for us, but it sure is for evolutionists. Worldwide sediment layers. If you line up Brazil and Africa, the sediment layers are essentially identical for quite a ways up. The only way you can explain that is if at one time those were part of the supercontinent that God had created when he brought land out of the water during the creation week. We believe that there was essentially one supercontinent, and then as it broke up quickly during the flood, the sediment had been laid down, but it broke up and quickly during the flood. And then in the Grand Canyon, you have sediment layers that have been laid down during the flood, and they're very soft. And as that new ocean basins are forming, all that continent-wide water goes rushing off, carving through the sediment layers and carves the Grand Canyon. And then the Colorado River falls. Here follows that path. Here's a laboratory example. In 1980, when the Mount St. Helens exploded and all that ice and snow on top of it, and then in addition, water moist vapor that had come up from the volcano, it brought all this sediment down. And notice how it laid down sediment that looks just like what you'd find in a canyon. And that was forming into rock within 5 years. Recent sediment deposition. The laying down of the sediment layers had to be gentle enough, but rapid enough that you could preserve rain marks, footprints. And I have one copy of Michael Lord's book over there left, one copy, How the Genesis Flood Shaped Our Earth. And he explains how this happens. We have soft tissue being compressed in sediment layers long before it can rot away so that we can actually see. This is a dolphin giving birth, and it hasn't had time to erode away. But another key telling factor is when you look at the thin layers, the razor thin between the layers in the Grand Canyon, there's no evidence of erosion, no evidence of soil formation. These layers were laid down in a matter of days and weeks, not millions of years apart, or they'd be eroded on the surfaces. We have tree trunks going up through all these sediment layers, and they didn't erode away because the sediment was laid down quickly. And then, so that's our five topics, and I've swept through them hyper fast. But biblical creation is good history that is supported by scientific facts. And Peter tells us that when we believe something, we better be able to give a defense for why we believe it. And I've already alluded to the fact that, first, it's going to be hard for you to remember all this stuff. Secondly, I go so fast, it's like drinking from a fire hose. And thirdly, our purpose is not so much to educate in these presentations as it is to encourage you, to enthuse you, to excite you about taking God at his word. And so how are you going to prepare yourself? So, clipboards. I'd encourage you, if you have an email address and you're not on our mailing list, sign up. Every Friday we send out info bites. And by the way, if you can't get the clipboard now, I put on the back table over there another clipboard, and you can sign up, and we'll start sending you. We have approximately 30,000 subscribers right now in Canada. And we'd encourage you to, because we give you all of the latest, where speakers are going to be, what the new books that have come out, videos, all kinds of stuff. And these are the kinds of things that we give you. So sign up for Info Bites. It doesn't cost a thing, and we'll just send you an email on Friday mornings. In fact, that's how I found out about CMI in the first place. I don't know how I ever subscribed to it, but it was through Info Bites that they were saying they needed more speakers. Actually, if I can just tell you a quick anecdote on that. When they announced that they were going to have a training session in Abbotsford, and I live in Toronto, and so I rationalized that I had to spend all that money to go to the training session. Well, then a few months later, they had a training session in Mississauga, so I no longer could rationalize. So I went out to Mississauga, and Richard Fangard, who was supposed to be your speaker here, I went and he did the training session. About 70 people attended that. I'm the only one that came out as a speaker out of that session. But it's great that they got all that material. We have a faith-building pack, which consists of Christianity for Skeptics and the Creation Answers book. And the Creation Answers book, you don't have to read it cover to cover. Just take the topics you're interested in. And there's well over 60 questions that are addressed. We have, by our PhD scientists, Evolution's Achilles Heel. And I have co-written things with some of these guys. They're great. And we have an accompanying DVD. Jonathan Sefardi, he has his PhD in chemistry and also a huge background in theology. And he has written a commentary on Genesis 1 to 11. And if you're not subscribing to Creation Magazine, you should be, because it's a great family-oriented magazine. We've been publishing it for something like 43 years or something like that, maybe even 48 years. And it's a great tool. It comes out once a quarter, and we only charge $7.50, and we haven't raised the price in years. If you subscribe to it, we only charge you when we're sending out the next edition to you. And here are some examples of articles in it. So we can pass around these clipboards with the forms on them. And if you want, tear off the bottom form, fill in both sides of it, and we'll set you up for, you don't have to pay anything right now, we'll set you up for a subscription to it. And if you buy your vacuum cleaner now, I'll throw in some vacuum bags. So if you subscribe now, the DVDs are on that end of the table. They're for sale, but you can take one of those DVDs and one of the Creation magazines right now. So that's just an incentive to have you sign up. We have two packs left of the children's five-book pack. They're a bestseller. So if you're interested, I have one more church I've got to go to in Kitimat tonight. So I may not have any left to take there. And we have the Creation Answers book for kids. I think I got a couple left of those, which is a great one. And there's two DVD Explorer packs left. And the Genesis Academy is a great tool for like Bible study. It's over a 12-week period, or an adult, like a men's breakfast, or a seniors, high school seniors classes, those kinds of things. There's an instructor guide and a DVD, and then the instructor has questions. We also have Creation Magazine Live, which I mentioned earlier. And we have a whole bunch of episodes coming up. We are just about ready to do one on Noah's Ark. And I've written three scripts that are coming up. One on chimps versus humans and their DNA. Another on the Garden of Eden. And then another one on the Ice Age. So these are coming up on our ninth season. So there's a lot coming there. And it's all free. And you don't want to spend a penny on any of this material. Go to creation.com. It's the easiest website to remember, creation.com. And we have thousands and thousands of articles. And we put up new articles every day but Sunday. And it's just filled with stuff, podcasts and books and all kinds of stuff.